OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Ki Tisa, also known as Ki Sisa, depending on how you pronounce your Hebrew. Recording and first broadcast Thursday, Yom Chamishi of Shabbat Parshat Ki Tisa. Today is Shushan Purim Katan, the 15th day of the first Adar. We'll talk about that too. In the secular calendar, it is the 21st of February. A number of weeks ago, I invited anyone of the listeners who would like to have a Mazel Tov announced on the air to contact me, and I have one I would like to share with the listenership. I will repeat my offer. Anyone who wants to say happy birthday, Mazel Tov, good luck on your marriage, on your divorce, whatever. And on the other side, to have a statement made in memory of someone, please contact me by email, tt@ou.org. That's the best address to use for me, and we'll be glad to include it on a subsequent show. This is a Mazel Tov to Avi and Katya Dean of Rehovot. That's in Israel, for those who don't know. On the births of their twin daughters, Nechama Liba and Rachel. With love, the Haas, Dean, and Waxberg families. Mazel Tov. And I guess we should say Mazel Tov for the twins. As regular listeners know, we always say Psalm 130 towards the beginning of the show. A couple of weeks ago, or really months already, I introduced at the Israel Center and on this show that on festive days or quasi-festive, pseudo-festive, whatever, days when we don't say Tachanun, we also won't say Psalm 130, but instead recite Psalm 121, Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph. And since today is Shushan Purim, which I'll talk about in a moment, we shall say 121. Shir la'ma'alot esa einai el haharim me'ayin yavo ezri. Ezri me'im Adonai osei shamayim va'aretz. Al yitain lamot raglecha al yanum shomrecha. Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomrecha, Adonai tzilecha al yad yaminecha. Yomam ha'shemesh lo yakeka v'yoreach baloyla. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra, yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor tseisecha uvoecha me'ata v'yad olam. You might have heard Tzeitecha, Kaminis Tzeischa. It sort of shows my ethnic Brooklyn origins, but you get the meaning either way. That was Psalm 121, and we will say, as we do every time, the prayer on behalf of Jews in difficult situations. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara liyirvacha u'meyafela la'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. Let me hold off on talking about Shushan Purim Katan until later. Let me now let you listen to a shiur that I just finished. Could have gone on a lot longer, except that I had to do the show. On the topic of Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, which is in this week's Torah reading of Ki Tisa, and maybe a different perspective on it. Anyway, with your permission, I wanted to talk about another way of looking at Chet HaEgel, which is a major theme in this week's Sedra. In the last couple of weeks, the fact that we have Truma Tetzaveh Ki Tisa Vayakel Pekudei, which is a five sedra span with a major theme of building the Mikdash, the Mishkan, then the Beit HaMikdash, it gives you a chance to talk about it from different angles. Because you don't say, well, this was last week's topic, it belongs this week, it belongs next week, it belongs the week after. But Chet HaEgel comes right in between. As you know, the account of the Mishkan in Truman Tetzaveh and the repeat of the actual carrying out of the instructions in Vayakhel and Pekudei. But I wrote that this week in Torah Tidbits. I spoke to you about it last week or the week before. And I want to look at it from a different angle. And I want to not compare, but I want to talk about what's known as two major, major sins, chataim. I was even thinking about that word. You know, there's the word chait, there's the word avera, there's the word pesha and avon, at least four terms for sinning, and each has different connotations. But I thought of an interesting analogy in modern Hebrew. In basketball, a foul is called an avera. And I realized, just from the model of basketball, that there are two kinds of fouls. There's an inadvertent foul, an accidental foul. You lunged for the ball, and you ended up hitting the arm of the person who had the ball, so the referee sees it, who's called, by the way, the shofet, the judge, and he sees the foul, he blows his whistle, and you get penalized. You get a foul on your record, your team gets a foul against it, and he gets the bonus of a free shot or two shots, as the case may be. Then there is the intentional foul, where the referee perceives that the player didn't just happen to hit the arm of the guy, but he gave him a body check and sprawled him on the floor. He thought he could get away with it, but he was caught. And he will often not only be penalized as a foul, but he could sometimes get a technical foul called against him. And if it was really a vicious thing, he could be suspended from the game or fined or whatever. So too with our averot, our sins of various types, where sometimes they carry with it a punishment, and the punishment is meted out, and that's it, you're finished. And it really depends upon motive. I didn't mean to do it is a good excuse sometimes, but there are consequences also. I did mean to do it. I mean, we know this from all the law shows that we see, of premeditated as opposed to accidental, as opposed to, well, he was there just to burglarize and he happened to see a knife there and he, you know, but he didn't come with a weapon, you know, all of those kind of things. Anyway, all of that is almost besides the point. The point is, if you take a look at the first sin of an individual, namely the eating from the tree of good knowledge of good and evil by Adam and Chava, and you look at the first national sin, that would be Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf. I want to suggest, not to mitigate the consequences of the sins, but another way of looking at them, a different way of looking at them. And I think it applies to both. Chet HaEgel, we'll start with that, then we'll go back to Adam HaRishon. Especially since the Catholic Church or the Christian philosophy considers that what they call original sin. Well, I don't know. So maybe I shouldn't say that. And maybe I'll have to erase it from the recording or put it on. Let's forget that I said it. Even though I'm going to leave that on the tape. Huh? Oh, okay. There's our expert. She says that's original sin. Anyway, let's focus on Chet HaEgel for a moment. One way that you look at Chet HaEgel is that we disappointed God. God had just said recently, in fact, 40 days before, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Lo yielach Elohim achirim al panai, there shall be no other gods before me. You shall not make graven images. And what in the world is this golden calf doing here? So commentaries try to lighten the sin by saying it wasn't the Jewish people, it was the Erev Rav, the riffraff that came with them from Egypt. That's very hard to claim for various textual reasons. Some say that they didn't weren't making a god or anything like that, but they were looking for a leader because Moshe wasn't there. One way or the other, it's a sin. It's a sin. And, you know, by the way, that's not an excuse for idolatry either. Person who says, no, I'm faithful to God, but I was having a difficult time with this concept of an invisible, intangible God. So I made this beautiful golden statue, and I don't worship it, I worship God, but this is represents it. That's Avodah Zarah. That's forbidden.
That's what they did, I heard.
Okay, whatever it is, you could explain it, but it doesn't whitewash the sin. What I want to suggest, though, is based on the question, what do you mean, God didn't know that they were going to do Chet HaEgel, or what did God think? It's not like that. I believe that in the case of Egel HaZahav, the people of Israel were demonstrating what is human nature. When a kid, I might be jumping from analogy to analogy, but when a kid defends himself when his parents come home and he did some mischief, he says, what do you expect me to do? Just sit and do nothing? You know, boys will be boys, or children are children, and it happens, and these things, so what are you getting so upset about? It's human nature. That does not say, therefore, it's okay, but it does help understand the sequence in the Torah of giving us the Torah, giving us the command of the Mikdash, and then the episode of Chet HaEgel, and then again the issue of the Mikdash, which says, because God says, I recognize that you are human beings, after all, who else would recognize that but the Creator? So he knows human nature, and human nature needs something tangible, not as a substitute for God, chas v'cholila, but some kind of focus. The danger is when the focus becomes too much. And it happens in our time also. If somebody goes to pray to the Kotel, he's doing avodah zarah. That's idolatry. If you go to the Kotel to pray to God at this holy place, that's beseder. You don't go to Kever Rachel to pray to Rachel Imenu. That's idolatry. You go to be inspired by the sanctity of the place, by the stories of Rachel Imenu, by the whole setting of Kever Rachel, in order to pray to God. Kiddush Levana is not praying to the moon. It irks me when someone comes in from Kiddush Levana and even jokingly says, I just blessed the moon, I just prayed to the moon. You don't. You don't pray to the moon. You pray to God, and in one of Rambam's 13 principles is, Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema, I believe with complete faith, that it is only God who is the object of our worship. So we can say, after Chet HaEgel, the same thing of, well, what do you expect? You know, that's us. That's a human failing. And God says, I know it's a human failing, and I want you to know that you are not perfect beings. Only God is a perfect being. What our challenge is not to become perfect, but to become the best human beings we can become. If Adam and Chava, before they ate from the tree of knowledge, were under the assumption that they were the greatest things in creation, they saw by their failing to the temptation of eating from that tree that this is what human beings do. And it doesn't say, therefore, it was all right what they did, but therefore, the rules of, what do they call it, rules of engagement, between God and people in general, and in the case of Chet HaEgel, between God and the Jewish people, are different. We are not equals to God. We are, have a certain place and position in this world, but God is the supreme being, bar none. And what puts us into our place in a certain way is the fact that the very first human beings, who are not just individuals, but they're representatives of mankind, they showed, they demonstrated that they fall to temptation, and we have to keep that in mind. You don't ask, wonder what the world would be like had they not eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, because they did. And they did because they're human. And because they're human and we are human, we can relate to that, and it puts a certain perspective on us. I saw in one of the commentaries that God intended, so to speak, to allow Adam and Chava to eat from that tree after the first Shabbat of creation. According to our tradition, they ate from it on the first Erev Shabbat, the day they were created. Which means it wasn't even the sin of eating from the tree, it was eating from the tree before they got permission. That would be analogous, sort of, to a person eating food. What, you see, I can't eat food? No, but you didn't make a bracha first. If you don't make a bracha first, you can't eat the food. And if you're that out of control with your human desires, that you have to stuff your face before you even wash for a motzi, make a motzi, break bread, and then make brachot what you have to, then there's something wrong with that. When you eat on Yom Kippur, there's something different that's wrong on that. Eating on Yom Kippur is forbidden. Eating every other day is permitted on the condition that you have a proper bracha to say. Now, I'm going obviously off the main track here, but the idea, I think, is there. Adam and Chava were given, you could eat from any tree in the garden you want, except for the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Eitz hadaat tov v'ra. If you eat from that, you're in trouble. And they ate from it, and they knew they were in trouble because they hid from God or tried to hide from God. And the rest, of course, is the history of fashion and clothing and everything else. But the point is that we don't have to look at it as a devastating sin from which we will never, ever be granted atonement, but rather look at it as a humbling illustration of human nature, and then to say, okay, if I were in that generation that came out of Egypt and saw all of these miracles and stood at Har Sinai, and I was concerned where Moshe is on the 40th day after he went up to Har Sinai, or the next morning or whatever, how would I have behaved? Would I have rallied to Moshe's call, to which Shevet Levi rallied, to attack the perpetrators and avenge God's honor? Would I have reveled in the calf? I say revel because I don't want to say worship. Whatever it was wrong. And we know the number. The Torah tells us that it was 3,000 men who reveled in the calf, and 3,000 out of a male population of over 600,000 is less than half of a percent of the population. If you add women and children, you're talking about a very tiny portion, but we are all guilty of Chet HaEgel on some level because we are all defined by that attitude that human beings have that resulted in such a thing. Where were the people who said, hey, didn't you hear what God said and Moshe repeated? You're not allowed to make a graven image. What are you doing? When the Egel, and according to many of the commentaries, it was not made by human beings, but it was a black magic kind of creature that came from Aharon's well-intended stalling tactics. But the result was that most people were stymied. They didn't know what to do. How do we react to this? What are we supposed to do? What do you mean, what are you supposed to do? You know what you're supposed to do. When Chava offered Adam to eat from that tree, he should have said, because he knew and he didn't get confused, we were commanded that we're not allowed to eat from this tree. Period. It was the only thing that he was commanded not to do. And he went and did it. So, again, it's a sin. I'm not saying it's not a sin. Call it a chait. Call it whatever you want. But we do call it that. We call it chait ha'egel. We call it chait Adam harishon or chait Adam and Chava. But it's more than that. It's different and it's more. And instructively, it's important to consider it a definition of human nature, which we are supposed to rise above. The excuse of, I always use this image. You don't bring a lion on trial for attacking a weak zebra at the edge of the flock and killing it and feeding his pride. And then all the other scavengers that come and take the leftovers. That's his nature. The lion can say to you, as the lion tried to say to the rabbits in Tawny Scrawny Lion, one of my favorite childhood books. You know Tawny Scrawny Lion? Anyway, it's all a bunch of animals who, the lion ate zebras on Monday and elephants on Tuesday and monkeys on Wednesday. And the animals were sort of in a quandary what to do. And it was one rabbit who decided that he's going to do something about it and invited the lion home for dinner. And the lion, kept being tempted with all of these juicy fat rabbits, this one and his brothers and sisters. But they kept feeding him carrot stew, and he got too full from it. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, that's a child's story. That's not what lions do. Lions are not bad animals because of what they do, because of their nature. And neither are wolves, by the way, big and bad, although in fairy tales they are always portrayed as big and bad. Think about, how they get bad press from Three Little Pigs and from Little Red Riding Hood and from Peter and the Wolf. And there are probably others. They're always bad, But they're not bad. They have a nature. Human beings...
I see from the recording that I was distracted at this point. What I wanted to say was human beings have nature too, but they also have the wherewithal through their intelligence, intellect, and decision-making process to rise above nature and to channel all of the negative urges or the potentially negative urges, we'll say, in a constructive direction. That is the definition of a human being and a Jew.
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
We were just finishing the shear to the folders with a comment that I made on an anecdote that a woman interjected. You had to be there for the whole discussion. But she said that when she was a little girl, a little boy in her school, when he learned the laws of Lashon Hara, gossip and talking bad about someone, he said, how can God make a law which is so much against what everybody wants to do? Which I think is a very clever thing for a child to ask, but it's an important question for anybody to ask and to answer. This was my comment, and then we'll pick up from the aftermath. I actually shut off the recording, and we ended up talking a longer time about a different topic, which maybe I'll bring up or maybe I won't.
There's a famous story that somebody came to the Chafetz Chaim, and he said, I am so taken by the body of laws that you wrote in your book about Lashon Hara that I'm going to take a vow of silence. The Chafetz Chaim said, that's not the solution. That's not what God wants. God gave you the power of speech to use it for positive things. The real challenge is not to speak Lashon Hara. There's so many good things to talk about. Say a Dvar Torah. Possible to avoid Lashon Hara. I know it's tempting, but it is certainly possible to control. And it's a big challenge, and that's why Chazal spent a lot of time talking about Lashon Hara and equating it to the worst of the Averot, because it is so much of a tendency. Idol worship.
You don't say anything. The next day you get it. How come you didn't tell me? You try that.
Oh, let me continue the idea, though, because once you know that something is human nature, your goal is not to erase the nature, it's to channel the natural tendencies in a kosher direction. I believe that's what Mishkan was. Mishkan is, was, will be a kosher channel for our religious energies, that if we didn't have a mikdash, and today if we didn't have the concept of a mikdash even, we might have to expend these energies in a non-healthy way, meaning Avodah Zarah. That's why there was such an allure in the past to Avodah Zarah. Today it's different. Yeah, but not to Avodah Zarah. But we also have things that have to be channeled.
But isn't it interesting?
Purim song. What? A Purim song? Purim is next month, not this month.
true, but not entirely true. So let's go back. In the time of Sanhedrin, past and future, so we could say back into the past and back to the future, in the time of Sanhedrin, when not only was each month declared sacred, the first of the month, Rosh Chodesh, by the pronouncement of the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, based on eyewitness testimony to the first visibility of the lunar crescent the night before, but also the Sanhedrin was empowered to make a yearly decision as to whether there would be another Adar after Adar, or if it would follow the normal month-to-month sequence of Nisan. In other words, during the first month of Adar, or under certain circumstances, any time from Rosh Hashanah onward, the Sanhedrin would announce, this year will be a Shana Me'uberet, a pregnant year carrying an extra month, and it was always viewed as the month that followed Adar would be another Adar, and that's the additional month. However, there is a rule, which goes all the way back to the time of the Mishnah, and maybe before that, or maybe not, that when there are two Adars, Purim is moved into the second Adar. The purpose of this is kedei lismoch geula legeula, in order to juxtapose the redemption story of Purim to, exactly 1 month later, the redemption story from Egypt. That means that, in essence, the first Adar is the real one, and, sure enough, it is a custom among Ashkenazi Jews to mark a Yortzeit, an anniversary of a death, in the first Adar. My mother, Oleha Hashalom, died on the 19th of Adar in a regular one Adar 12-month year. When it came to the first time there were two Adars, my brothers and I asked the question, in which Adar are we to observe the Yortzeit? Sfardim seemed to favor the second one, Ashkenazim the first, with the additional request, suggestion, recommendation, that you observe both. And that is what we've been doing, and what we will continue to do from year to year, or from year to whenever it happens, as we will be doing it this year. So, it's a complicated dispute. I mentioned it last week or the week before. But the bottom line is that when Purim was moved from the first Adar to the second Adar, its place in the calendar during the first Adar became known as Purim Katan, that was yesterday, the 14th of Adar Rishon, and Shushan Purim Katan, which has particular interest for those of us who live in Yerushalayim, since it's we who observe the 15th. There are other places as well. We'll talk about that next month, Amir Tzashem. So today on the calendar is the 15th day of the first Adar. It is called Shushan Purim Katan. Its practical applications are negligible. We don't say Tachanun, we don't say Lam Natseach, we don't say, we don't say the Yehi Ratzon after Torah reading, and Keil Erech HaPayim before we take out the Torah. Funerals that take place today are supposed to be reduced in the amount of eulogizing, and other passages that are generally not said on a day when there is no Tachanun. A bride and groom who are to be married this evening do not have to fast, or do not fast today, as is the custom of many people to fast on the day of their wedding. So it is a pseudo or a quasi festive occasion. And I just played La Yehudim Hayata Ora Vasimcha Visason Vikor. It is a quote from the book of Esther, which we do not read this month. We will read Amir Tzashem next month in the second Adar. But I felt the song was appropriate not only to mark Shushan Purim Katan, but also it is a prayer which we borrow to the introductory passage before Havdalah on Motzoi Shabbat. Every week, we say La Yehudim Hayata Ora V'Simcha V'Sason V'Kar. To the Jews, there was light and festivity, etc., etc. Kain Tihye Lanu, so may it be for us that we should be able to celebrate as the Jews in Shushan and the rest of Ahasuerus' kingdom celebrated at that time. It is also a prayer that we can utter any time of the year to God, that we look forward to the time, speedily hopefully, that we will all be able to say again, La Yehudim Hayata Ora V'Simcha V'Sason V'Kar. Train of thought. The Jerusalem Post this morning carried the story, which you may or may not be aware of the monopoly competition for the top 20 or 28 countries, cities rather, in the world, that will make up the property names on a new international edition of Monopoly. Apparently, the Israeli consulate in New York has been on a major, major campaign to have Jews sign up. There's a petition online on the Monopoly site where you could vote every day, repeatedly, and people have been voting for Jerusalem to the point where it has risen. First time I looked a couple of weeks ago, it was number 27, which would not make the initial cut of 20. And then I looked again, and all of a sudden it was at number 7. I think it's up to number 4 now. And yesterday, for the first time, Jerusalem was listed on the website of Monopoly among all the other cities as not belonging to any particular country. In other words, they had Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and New York, USA, and London, United Kingdom, and they had been printing Jerusalem, Israel. Yesterday, Jerusalem lost its designation as Israel, and it was listed as a city without a country, as opposed to all the other cities that are listed on the website that do have a country. Today or yesterday, Monopoly Company Incorporated, whatever, made the decision that they will drop the country names of all the cities so that San Francisco is no longer identified as USA. It is just the city of San Francisco. Warsaw is no longer designated as being in Poland. It is just Warsaw. This rather than put the name Israel after Jerusalem, having removed it upon the complaint of some, quote, angry Palestinians who objected to calling Jerusalem part of Israel. Now this is, it would be funny if it were just the game of Monopoly, but unfortunately this is a serious issue. It is something that goes back many, many years. I've mentioned it here on Torah Tidbits Audio in the past. My daughter, my youngest daughter, is about to turn 22. And 22 years ago, when I brought her to the United States Consulate in Jerusalem to register her as an American citizen, which she was by virtue of birth, and I filled out all the documents, including a translation of her Hebrew birth certificate, place of birth, Jerusalem, Israel, the clerk at the United States Consulate 22 years ago pulled out a pen right in front of me, did not do it surreptitiously, right under my nose, crossed out the word Israel to leave place of birth as Jerusalem. I renewed a passport a number of years ago, an American passport, and it was stamped, in that embossed kind of stamp, the United States Consulate General, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Not Jerusalem, Israel, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. In the whole issue, I've said this before and I'll keep saying it, and some people poo-poo it, and I don't think you should poo-poo it. In the whole issue of Jerusalem being the capital of Israel and getting countries to recognize it as such by bringing their embassies to Jerusalem rather than in Tel Aviv, the two countries, the only two countries in the world that used to have embassies in Jerusalem were El Salvador and Costa Rica. Both of them very recently moved their embassies to Tel Aviv, partially because of the pressure of the world community not to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It's a sore point. I am a Jew, and from the Jewish perspective, it's a sore point that we have this issue, but there is no question that we view Jerusalem to be the eternal capital of the Jewish people, as well as the state of Israel. And Israel itself, of course, recognizes that. When I did a little investigation into this, I found something surprising. The United States of America, the supposed best friend of Israel in this world, the United States of America not only does not recognize Israel, Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, even though the Congress has passed resolutions as such trying to get the official policy to be so, not only does the United States not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, the United States of America does not recognize Israeli sovereignty over any part of Jerusalem. I am sitting here in my office at Rehov, on Rehov Keren Kayemet, in the heart of Rehavia, the heart of Jerusalem, and the United States does not recognize the sovereignty of the state of Israel over the place where I am sitting. I live in Ramat Eshkol. Ramat Eshkol is across the famous or infamous Green Line. It is in territory that was forest before 67, that was in no man's land or held by Jordan. And when Israel regained all of Jerusalem, one of the first communities, maybe the first community they built, was Ramat Eshkol, as a neighborhood at the extreme north of the city. Now it's almost in the middle of the city. It's still a little north, but it's there. But officially, it is over the proverbial Green Line. I shouldn't say proverbial, over what they call the Green Line. And United States not only doesn't recognize Israeli sovereignty over that which came back under its rule in 67, but over even the Jerusalem that they had from 1948. I heard from someone that the United States offered to recognize, quote, Western Jerusalem or New Jerusalem as being under Israeli sovereignty, and Israel, to my delight as well as surprise, refused to allow that. They said, Jerusalem is our capital, Jerusalem is under our sovereign rule, and you recognize it all, or we're not interested in partial recognition. How accurate that is, I'm not sure, but it's a point. And it's a sore point. And here, Monopoly goes ahead and does the same thing. The article in the Post said it was a middle management person who couldn't find his boss, so he made a unilateral decision without consultation to pull out the word Israel. That obviously was responded to by the ire of the U.S. of the Israeli consulate in the States. And rather than apologizing and putting Israel back, because after all, that's the way it is, instead, they took off the countries of every other city that's listed there. All right, I took a lot of time on this, and I'm sorry, but at least I did explain what Shushan Purim is. And there are many things in the Parsha. In a few minutes that I have left, I will try to make a couple of more comments. Let me say this. The discussion that I referred to earlier that continued beyond the shear that I had taped. I had shut off the tape recorder and we just kept sitting there and talking out other things. I referred to a midrash. Oh, I'll tell you exactly how it started. A woman asked, how come there is so much minute detail in the written Torah about the building of the Mishkan, the Mikdash, the sanctuary,
the Kohen has to wear this and this and has this and on this on it and this furnishing has this and all kind of details, when other areas of mitzvot, which would be more applicable to her, like the laws of Shabbat, for example, do not have that same kind of detail in the written Torah. Now, we don't have time to go into all of this, but it is an issue of the written word and the oral law. Whatever is not spelled out in detail in the written word is elaborated upon in the oral tradition. Our tradition is that it was God himself who explained certain things contained in the Torah to Moshe to be transmitted to the people orally. This concept is essential for Torah Judaism and is distinguished from all other approaches, I think, to the study of the Bible. Briefly put, the five books of Moses are not the sum total of God's word to the Jewish people in what we call the Torah. And anyone who thinks that it is subject to gross misinterpretation and presentation and distortion of the content of the Torah. To be continued sometime in the future, but on that note, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameya.